You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, you'll hear my interview with Salam, a member of the Syria Solidarity Collective based in Toronto. We talk about the Syrian uprising, anti-imperialism and the left, the ongoing need for international solidarity with the people of Syria, and more. We recorded this interview a couple of months ago in early January 2020. Since that time, Assad's ongoing genocidal assault on Idlib province has displaced more than 1 million people. The Turkish government has kept its borders closed with Syria and left refugees and children to freeze to death while pushing thousands of Syrian refugees towards Europe through Greece. At the same time, the Greek authorities, under pressure from fascist goons and supported by the European Union, have been using all means, including tear gas, sound lighting bombs, and water cannons, to drive away refugees attempting to cross the border. As borders around the world are literally closing, the Canada-US border is hardening in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Trudeau has reassured us that supply chains, including trucking, will not be affected, signaling his willingness to ultimately prioritize the well-being of the economy over the well-being of those made vulnerable by border conflict and state violence around the world, including Syrians fleeing the Assad regime. I'll leave you with these words from Harsha Walia. We need solidarity with all people and an internationalist response with care and solidarity for those who are most vulnerable, not escalation of border imperialism and racism. Now here's Salam.
So my name is Salam. I am a Syrian Palestinian. I lived almost entire my life in Syria. Was born in Syria, but for Palestinian parents. I lived in Syria until late 2013. So I experienced almost 2 years and a half of the Syrian uprising, and I participated during that exceptional moment in our life, who the people who lived in Syria. And after that, I went to Lebanon. I also was working as a journalist at the same time for different media outlets, covering socioeconomic issues in Syria and the region. So after that, it was very difficult to continue in Syria. So I had to leave to Lebanon, as many of my friends also before me and after me did that, activists. Some of them didn't make it and went to prison and tortured, and we can talk about this. And I stayed in Lebanon for some time, and then I came to Canada. I continued my work as a journalist from here in Canada, but also my activism. And also I am doing a PhD in political science. I am active with the Syria Solidarity Collective, which is a Toronto-based group here in Canada that started with after the Syrian Revolution in solidarity with the Syrian people and seeks political freedom and social justice for Syria and the people of Syria. So I've been active with them since a few years now, after like 1 year after I arrived and got to know them. And yeah, this is who I am.
I guess to start, could you give us some background or an overview of the Syrian Revolution and also maybe a snapshot of what things are like today, several years later?
So the Syrian Revolution started as part of the Arab Spring, what's known as the Arab Spring, which is the protest movements that started in late 2010 and continued 2011, during 2011, and swept through many Arab countries actually in the region, like massive, massive protests that brought down authoritarian, long-standing authoritarian regimes in 5 or 6 countries, but also other very critical and serious protests that couldn't develop and constitute a serious threat to other regimes in 5 more countries. So in total, like there were at that time massive protests, popular movements, protests, not organized, grassroots movements in very authoritarian regimes generally with varying degrees, but all really authoritarian regimes that prohibits any kind of political activism generally, whether formal or informal. So these really brave movements, popular movements, started at that time and started in Tunisia in late 2010. And then early 2011, Egypt followed. And these two countries experienced like few weeks really of the mass demonstrations. And then that led to the overthrow of the head of the state, basically. Not a radical transformation, but achieved some of political openings and political liberties and allowed social movement to organize more and to develop more. So this constituted a threat for sure for the elites generally, the elites that stayed after the head of the state were overthrown in Tunisia and Egypt, and then many other countries followed, Yemen, Libya, and Syria, of course, was part of those countries. So Syria, this is the context of the Syrian uprising, people in the region demanding political freedom, dignity, and better life because of very poor life conditions. Authoritarian regimes that have been in ruling over those people since many decades in each country, corrupt regimes, and people just fed up with this situation and started this movement. And because it was across the region, so this constituted also a more support for the people. Like there was an example to emulate, just the Tunisian uprising and the Egyptian uprising succeeded in overthrowing the authoritarian regimes that all people thought they're gonna stay. So this has really encouraged people to start their movement. And this was the case in Syria. Syria in particular has a very special thing, is that it's, I would say, the most authoritarian state in the region at the time, and still, I think. It's a kind of totalitarian state, really, more than authoritarianism. The state controls everything, controls our life and schools. Since we were kids in the school, we were like soldiers more than kids, being taught to certain beliefs and norms. So this kind of doctrination exists in Syria and very, very strong. It's not easy thing. So the fear among the people is very, very strong. And this is a big barrier for any social movement. Oh, of course, no, the regime until the Syrian uprising would not tolerate even the smallest sign of dissent or any kind of opposition. groups. So many people throughout the history of the country during the rule of the Syrian regime, which is the Ba'ath Party, one party rule, ruled the country since 1963, the Ba'ath Party, and then in 1970, within the party there was a coup led by Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president Bashar al-Assad. A coup within the party controlled the state more, and it turned into a totalitarian state since then, since the 1970, and continued. So it was very difficult to start, and I mean a movement or an uprising or any kind of dissent. But there was this exceptional moment in the region, which is the Arab Spring, that encouraged people, thought this is the example that we're waiting for. We can do it as as our brothers and sisters in the region did it before us. So they started this protest, but the exceptionalism of the Syrian regime, as I said, proved true. So it was the response of the state violence towards the people on the ground was very different, obviously, from any other authoritarian regime in the region.
Can you talk a bit about how that social movement was organized?
Yeah, so like from the beginning, as I said, there was no really political opposition, clear and strong political opposition in Syria. That's not was not allowed. Political dissidents and opponents to the Syrian regime were in prisons or outside, but they're very strongly monitored and followed by state agencies, state security forces. No political parties, of course, like just in names, but not no actual presence on the ground. So in this sense, and no social movement, like independent social movements or activists. This is, as I said, the people should understand that this is usually not very well understood about Syria, that Syria under Assad before the uprising and even after, but we can talk about this more. But before the uprising, it was really totalitarian state. Everything goes through the state security forces, so people can't organize by any way, any means. If you want to have in your home a gathering of more than 15 people for social events or something, you need to get permission from the security forces. A wedding, you need to get a permission from security forces. So everything goes through security forces. The society is controlled very, very strongly. And people are monitored. People fear from each other. This is the culture of fear that the regime has created before the uprising. And this, of course, to prevent this any kind of organization and any kind of resistance to the state, to the authoritarian regime, very authoritarian regime. So at the same time, there is the other perception about misunderstanding or claim about the Syrian regime is anti-imperialist, in the sense that we understand anti-imperialism, not just against Western interventions and imperialism, but also, for example, have this supports the well-being of the people. In fact, in Syria, it's the opposite in terms of economic and social issues. During the years of the Bashar al-Assad before the uprising, one decade before the uprising, the state, the regime has conducted a very aggressive neoliberal reforms in Syria that really has caused massive numbers of unemployed, increased the unemployment rates and poverty among people, destroyed rural areas that used to get certain agriculture subsidies and this kind of things. So these subsidies and support from the state institutions decreased and ended during these decades. And at the same time, people were not allowed to organize themselves and find solution for certain problems they're facing, including environmental problems. The drought, for example, that caused lots of displacement. Over between 1 and 1.5 million people were displaced from their rural areas to the surrounding of the cities, the big cities, because of the drought and the corruption of the state that could not do anything, or it was not interested in doing anything at that time. So this is also this misperception about the Syrian regime, that is kind of socialist regime among leftists. So this is the background of the lots of political and socioeconomic grievances, actually, accumulated along during the decade before the revolution, and caused people to just burst after the Arab Spring. So people with this kind of real grievances, not able to organize very well, no political parties or social movements that established before and can really organize. So people start just trying to organize by themselves. Individuals start to come together and call for protest using social media at the time. At the beginning, very few people responded, just because of this fear, barrier of fear. It's very, the consequences are very serious for this. People could just disappear in prison if they go to protest and no one participate, or a few people. And that's, this happened. Like in the first 3 weeks of these calls for protests, people were arrested. Lots of people and my friends were arrested and went to prison. They could stay for years. I mean, 10 years. Some people stayed 20 years in prison, including some of my friends or relatives. So before the uprising. But then after that, the uprising started to gather momentum. People started to break this barrier of fear, as I said, to a large degree because of the Arab Spring, the success of the Arab Spring in other countries. So people started to participate more and more, and the state, the regime started to crack down from the beginning. So after the uprising gathered some momentum, the regime started to shoot at people on each demonstration. So after probably 1 month of the Syrian uprising starting, which was in March, mid-March, 2011. 1 month after that, the protest gathered momentum, and it was a big threat to the regime, and the regime just decided to crack down very viciously and brutally. So every day since then, every day regime killed tens of protesters in around the region, because also the uprising, the protest started everywhere or developed and started to go against the regime everywhere in the country. So different points. And because of the presence of security forces everywhere, so the uprising tried to not gather in certain point, and couldn't actually to gather momentum and numbers at certain points and cities, as was happening in other countries like in Egypt and Tunisia. So people start to go protesting in few numbers, but in many, many areas, like 100 protests at the same time, the same day, each Friday, for example, or sometimes more, at least 200 protests in different areas of the country. So it can overwhelm security forces and they can't respond. And this succeeded in some way and really led to the protest gathering momentum more and more, but the regime being more brutal and more aggressive towards the protest. So after the regime started using violence more and more, this also probably gave the opposite outcome or results that the regime was wishing. The repression of the regime actually caused more protest, more people to go protest, people mourning the death of other people every day, and each gathering turned into bigger and bigger and bigger gathering, and then actually the protests movement took over some very important cities. Security forces were displaced from these cities, like in Hama, for example, and in Deir Zor at certain point. But mostly in rural areas because the presence of security forces there is weaker. So at this point, we can say a few months after the uprising started, there emerged what we call in Syria a liberated area. We started to call them liberated area, which means liberated from the state, from the presence of the Syrian regime, from the presence of the state. So these area actually were very important and during the Syrian uprising. They were totally free from everything actually at the beginning, so especially. They were free from the state, free from money, from greed. Like many really imagined these revolutionary areas, liberated areas, as a new, as kind of constituting the prospect for a new social order that could serve the foundation for a different future for the Syrian people. So in these areas also emerged local councils, what we call. People started to get to organize themselves to, and they formed local council to in different liberated areas. At the time, also armed resistance developed against the state because of the state violence, because no area could stay free from the Syrian from the state present without some kind of resistance and armed resistance at the time. So civilians and fighters elected local councils in these liberated areas to provide local services to the population that remained in those areas. Lots of people fled this area because they were very dangerous. I'll talk about this. But those who stayed actually elected local councils, and people struggled to cope with electricity, water, food shortages because mainly because of the daily, really daily destruction and shelling and bombing of these liberated areas by Assad regime and its backers later. But at that time, the Assad regime was with its backers just supported him politically. Maybe some of the backers, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, came early to Syria to help the Assad regime crack down. But so people organize these local councils and try to provide these social services as much as possible according to the circumstance, the very harsh circumstances. These liberated areas were daily targeted by shelling, by bombing, by airplanes, fighter jets, every day. The Assad regime obviously went crazy about this, about these liberated areas in particular, because this constitute the main threat of the state. They tried to develop an alternative, and this is the most scary thing about them for the Syrian regime and its backers, and honestly for the whole world. The whole world, I mean, other states that even they say they're against the Syrian regime, but for sure they don't want to see this kind of organization. They don't want to see people organizing themselves. And we'll talk about this, the difference between states who support the Assad regime and states who claim to support the overthrow of Assad or the Syrian uprising or the Syrian people. In my opinion, the difference is just about what the Western states want, probably authoritarianism without Assad in our country, while Russia and China and those countries who support Assad wants authoritarianism with Assad. They both agree about the importance of authoritarianism in our region, not just in Syria, in the region as a whole. They agree that authoritarianism should stay and people should not be allowed to organize themselves. So these experiences, these local councils and liberated areas in Syria actually frightened the Syrian state, its backers, and the whole world in this sense. So one thing about these areas that I think important is that they were very unique during the Arab Spring. No other country that experienced the Arab Spring went as radical as the Syrian Revolution at the time, like liberating whole areas from the state. This is really a big a big moment for the Syrians. Other states could actually, as I said, bring down the head of the state while keeping the structure intact. In Syria, that was not even possible, not just the violence and the totalitarianism of the Syrian regime also imposed this kind of response from the protesters as well. So the collapse of the state machine and police control actually opened this exceptional space, I would say, for ordinary people to start an extraordinary effort to for self-realization and self-governing in this area. And that was really amazing. This is the most important moment in the Syrian revolution that every Syrian would talk about if you speak to, especially those who lived in Syria at the time. There were really moments of exceptional time with dysfunctional state and I would say novel popular consciousness that developed in a very short period of time. We're talking about months of this starting under extremely harsh and brutal conditions. And this new awareness and consciousness was really qualitatively different than the pre-revolutionary one. As we say, it was a moment for us in which the old order is collapsing and the new order had not emerged yet, as Gramsci once said, but is emerging in front of our eyes. And this moment, as I said, allowed this opportunity for ordinary people who never before participated in politics, who lived under authoritarian regimes entire their life, as me, I was born under this the same family ruling Syria, the same dynasty ruling Syria. This was a big opportunity to experience politics at the beginning, to start organizing and start this really experience of self-realization, as I said, in the street, farms, neighborhoods, universities, factories. Everything was different. In the army, lots of defections in the army. The army became disintegrated after a few months of the uprising. People just turned against everything that the state represents at the time. So it was a new social order starting at that time. And I would say this is the exceptional moment, the best moment during the Syrian uprising.
Why do you think people elsewhere haven't maybe appreciated how important that story is or kind of extended meaningful solidarity to the revolutionary movement in Syria, aside maybe from people in Rojava, who I can ask you about that in a second too?
Yeah, actually, like what happened afterwards is important. The developments of the Syrian uprising, it's the social movement, the national democratic social movement in Syria constantly has been targeted by the Syrian regime and its backers. Those activists who started this experience, who started organizing, were arrested or assassinated or pushed into exile, like me and my friends. And this is very serious. It's not like I was working with a group in Syria, in Damascus, who were in Damascus. And in Damascus, the state was in control. The most strong and powerful presence of the state was in Damascus, the capital. And we're working underground, basically, with a group of youth in certain areas organizing protest. And they were arrested. The majority of our group were arrested. 10 of them, the core group, were arrested, tortured in the Syrian prisons, and tortured to death, you know? So all of them. So this was, and this happened with many, many other groups. We're talking about hundreds, you know. This is the nature of the Syrian uprising. We're not talking about three, four, five groups dominating the Syrian uprising. Literally at least 100 groups between civilians and armed, even more than that, over 100 groups. And this is partly because, as I said, because of the authoritarianism of the state, not allowing any body to be organized before the uprising. So people start to experience that during the uprising. So after that, with the violence and everything, the Syrian uprising developed, actually. The social movement was weakened. Another radical Islamist movement, factions developed with regional interventions, you know, from other countries in the region like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, on the supporting certain Islamist movements against the Syrian regime because they thought it's gonna fall. And at the same time, other countries supporting the Syrian regime. So it turned into this kind of conflict dominating the picture, where the social movement, the democratic social movement was squeezed in between. And from that point on, all the mainstream media started to focus on this other conflict, which is more interesting for people to talk about international politics and state nation states fighting and conflict. And sadly, we can understand that from the social, from the mainstream media and the states around the world, but the left also got engaged in that kind of narrative, you know? So after this point, at the beginning, it was embarrassing for any leftist to support the Assad regime, although it was considered anti-imperialist, as I said. But it was very difficult because it was obvious what was the Assad regime doing. It was peaceful, a massive protest around the country, and the state is cracking down and killing people every day. So it was very difficult for any leftist to support that. But after the social movement was weakened and this kind of conflict turned into what seemed to be a proxy war, well, some would say, or the engagement of certain Islamist fundamentalists in the against the Syrian regime. So this narrative, leftist narrative, started to appear that we should support the Syrian regime. We should support the state against these fundamentalists who are supported by the Western government. This is the big narrative, which I would say it's false. It's not true. So in this sense, the main problem with the political stance of the left is denying, for me and for us Syrians and people who are still fighting, both anti-imperialism and we are both against imperialism and against authoritarianism. This is our stance. The problem with the classical position of the left from Syria now is denying the civilians protesting agency. Millions of people, as I said, protesting and struggling for freedom and dignity. Those people just become agents of external powers in this narrative, you know. But the fact is that those people have never been minority movements. They're the majority of the people against their local regimes. And they represent the democratic aspirations of the overwhelming majority of the population. So at the core of this flawed vision and narrative is reducing politics of the region to geopolitical framework. This is the main problem, in my opinion, to the binary worldview of imperialist, anti-imperialist, without any consideration of the local, population, the agency of the people of the region. And it interprets politics only through the lens of relations between nation states, you know, and excludes inner social dynamics. Does not see that. The local is absent completely and obscured for an ever greater role of the global and the international politics in the region. So, this leads to local struggle being reduced to state conflicts, and this would produce this kind of narrative, like ignoring the movement, social movement, even if it's weak, you know, even if it's weak. I admit it's weak now on the ground, but people have, like millions of people now in Syria, have aspirations, legitimate aspirations, and just aspiration to freedom and dignity. You know, we need to stand with those people, not with any state, not with the Syrian state, not with the United States, not with any state in the country. This is our solidarity should be with those people, and we should reach out to them. We should know what they're demanding and what they're facing and what they're struggling against. I would say it's very frustrating, honestly. It's very frustrating and disturbing this narrative comes from certain circles of the left, not all parts of the left, obviously, but unfortunately some, to see that when civilians in the global south, when they demand democratic future in a regime controlled by anti-Western dictator, so no matter how brutal or fascist that dictator or that regime, those people are immorally opposed or rejected. Their demands just ignored. Because this authoritarian state that oppresses those people since decades, it's considered anti-Western. And this is really, we need to reconsider this kind of thinking about solidarity and support. Are we stand in solidarity with states, even if they are anti-Western, and even if they are authoritarian and really brutally and suppress the people, or we stand with those people who are fighting for their lives? And this narrative, I would end with that, this narrative actually justifies and deny, justifies the oppression of the state to reduce politics to just international politics and ignore the suffering of the people. It justifies the authoritarianism in the region and the brutal oppression of the ordinary people in countries considered anti-imperialist. It leads, as it is now, from parts of the left against the Syrian people, the Syrian in Idlib, for example, now, and many parts of the Syria. The result becomes a dehumanization campaign targeting those people who are really, really the poorest and most vulnerable civilians. So this is the sad thing about this.
Yeah, absolutely. It also, to me, kind of echoes what you said about even like Western states also sort of supporting authoritarianism in the region for their own supposed political goals, even if those goals are they want to see certain states win against other states.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I agree. We agree. It's the Western countries also supporting authoritarian regimes in very clearly, of course, in those that are allied to them, like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and these countries that considered pro-Western in the region, but also supporting authoritarianism in Syria and these countries that anti-Western. But, you know, as I said, they need authoritarianism without Assad for their interests. But they don't need freedom of the Syrian people. They don't want any kind of democracy. We saw what happened in Egypt after the uprising. And in 2013, there was a coup by the military against the democratically elected president at the time. And this coup was supported by the United States. This was 2013, not decades ago, you know, and we know that about Syria. The people of Syria know that Western countries that are against Assad regime are not with the Syrian people. They're with their interests. They want to preserve certain kind of authoritarianism that best represents their interests.
You're listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or the podcast version, which you can find at fromembers.libsyn.com. Could you tell me a bit about the solidarity organizing that you're involved with in Toronto and about the Syrian Solidarity Collective?
So, as I said, the Syrian Solidarity Collective is a Toronto-based group started with after the Syrian uprising. And started in solidarity with the Syrian uprising, actually, to support the people, to amplify their voices outside the country. And it acquired even more important role after, as I said, after the developments of the Syrian uprising and the emergence of this kind of mainstream narrative about Syria, about being a conflict, a regional conflict, for example, a proxy war, or a conflict between a legitimate state and for Islamist fundamentalists, this kind of false narrative. So our group started to focus on the certain discourse that I just laid out here. So the group actually strive for ending political tyranny in Syria. We consider attaining political liberty to be a precondition to realizing any kind of egalitarian social and economic relations. So as I said, the basic, really basic political freedom or political rights are not there in Syria. So no way people can organize around anything else, anything more radical, I mean, if they don't attain this at least basic level of right to organize and to defend themselves and their rights. So this is a necessary step, in our opinion, so we focus on that. We have to be, in our group, we push this discourse of being against both authoritarianism and imperialism. And they both connected. They're not separate. So we can't advance one goal while like postponing the other or just ignoring the other. We can't be just anti-imperialist and just don't care about authoritarianism and how it's wreaking havoc in the lives of the ordinary people on the ground. Because those are our allies, the people on the ground who are our allies and the people who need to support. So this is our group. Actually, we organize different events. We try to reach out to the Syrian community in Canada, especially those who came recently. But also, as I said, different events that just amplify this narrative, the voices of the people on the ground, who still, by the way, fighting and struggling against both the state and its backers, which means Russia and Iran, and against Islamist fundamentalists. When we talk about Idlib now, it's represented as the stronghold for jihadists, without considering that there are 3 million people, like who's fighting against both, you know? So this is what we try in this group to do here, to push this narrative and to affirm this different voice of the left.
When I think of, you know, a struggle in the region that I've heard a lot of support for from the left, from anarchists, people, like the way that people talk about Kurdish people fighting for self-determination in Rojava is usually very positive and supportive, and people seem pretty motivated to extend solidarity to that struggle and support it, which I guess I don't necessarily think is bad, but I'm curious about your perspective on that particular struggle in Syria, I guess, and how, and the relationship between that and the broader anti-Assad movement.
Yeah, I think like this is a sensitive issue among leftists, especially talking about Rojava and the relationship between Rojava and the Syrian revolution, and the complexity around the issue. Obviously, it's not easy. It departs or disturbs the classic stances, political stances, and narratives of the left. In this regard, I would say, in general, in our view as a group, of course, we stand with the Kurds in the region, not just in Syria, and even in Iran and Turkey. They're oppressed. They have been oppressed for a very long time, and we stand with them in solidarity to achieve their right of self-determination, you know, in the region generally. We differ with the political party that represent the Rojava right now. Now under the Syrian Democratic Forces, that's overwhelmingly Kurds, the members of the Syrian Democratic Forces. We disagree with certain practices in the region, at the same time not consulting the population of the region, proposing a certain political future of the region without the necessary consultation and consideration of the people on the ground who are from different backgrounds and ethnicities, you know. The majority of the people in that Rojava region now, that's called, they don't call it Rojava, even the Syrian Democratic Forces, they stopped calling Rojava, but the majority of people are Arab at that enclave or territories, these territories. So this requires more participation and consultation with the people on the ground, in our opinion. There are lots of authoritarian practices against people on the ground, but also against other parties, and even Kurds, Kurdish parties, other than this particular party. We're not necessarily against. We see lots of positive things with this experience. We can understand why and how. This is a very long-standing and old political party. So, and they managed to keep this area safe from the bombardment of the Syrian regime and other liberated areas, as I said. It came as a negotiation between the Syrian regime and this party, and it stayed like this, and then it came under the protection of the United States, as you know. And this is it's not an easy thing to understand a narrative. We understand the support that they get from the almost all leftists around the world, but it's also, we know, and all people know, that it's supported by the United States. They participated with the United States in the war in terror, something we viciously against upholding this kind of thinking and narrative, the war in terror, you know. And and this is the disturbing thing for us, even among leftists, among anti-war movements, this is considered a good war, you know. No voices. Now you can hear all the people are angry and taking to the street against any American action against Iran with the recent developments, and we're with that, you know. But when the United States bombed cities, like destroyed the whole cities in Syria, like Raqqa and Mosul in Iraq, to fighting ISIS, claiming that fighting ISIS or liberating the area from ISIS, no voice came from these circles, anti-war movements and the left, because this is considered a good war. And this is the more disturbing thing about the developments of the narrative of the left and the war movement, you know. I see our this region is have many different communities, political but also ethnic communities in the region, northeastern Syria, and this requires more consultation, democratic consultations, and the self-determination of the people should be extended to the people of the entire region, you know, not just the Kurds. This is our points. I don't know if this is clear enough. As I said, it's a little bit complicated and sensitive issue, in my opinion.
I think from the outside, I feel like it's often hard to know or to get a sense of those specific complexities, because there's people in the region with different groups who are very clearly stating that, yes, this is a multi-ethnic project or liberatory project. Yeah, I don't know. It's not always easy to sort of figure out what the reality is.
Yeah, we agree. We agree that it has the potential to be a very clear liberation project, you know. But also, right now in practice, it has a very clear authoritarian tendency towards the people on the ground, but because any other parties and social movements and activists in the area, you know. So also, of course, we know that they have agreements with the Syrian regime. When we talk about tension between the revolution and not the Kurds, actually, but those who have a hegemonic position among the political movements of the Kurds right now, this tension starts from there, you know, from the negotiation between this Kurdish party and the Syrian regime to have certain autonomy in that area. And then all the support they got from other countries, including the United States. And the Syrian state, the Syrian genocidal state, it's not just a state, is the main enemy of the Syrian people. So, of course, this tension is going to come up. But at the same time, we understand that it's complicated. We don't hold a very simple position. We understand that there is a massive threat to the Kurds and the life of the Kurds from Turkey, you know, from certain Islamist factions. We understand that it's difficult. It's not easy to just take stances that we see that there are implications, very, very serious implications for the lives of civilians in that region, for the lives of Kurds. But also we had to see the picture from different directions and different angles. You know, we don't hold as a very simple stance on this issue, like saying we support this project totally. We don't have any any opinion against it or restrictions or things. No, we have actually a lot. We can't just state our position like against or with, you know.
For sure. Yeah. I'm curious if there are, especially because of the way that the Syrian revolution and that particular struggle was militarized with that just intense amount of state violence, do you see lessons from that or things people could take from that in other contexts? Like, I know right now there are like large kind of pro-democracy or anti-authoritarian, I'd maybe say, social movements against authoritarian regimes or military dictatorships, I guess, throughout the region. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, sure. There are, like, theoretically speaking, yes, there are lessons to be learned from that. Armed struggle, for sure, weakens massive social movements. Like, street power is weakened by armed struggle because it's the nature of armed struggle. It's elite. To some degree, or develop to a way to be more organized around certain groups. It needs funding, so it's very vulnerable to interventions from outside. And people, when they are in a very tragic and catastrophic situation, they tend to accept help from anyone almost, especially after some time, not from the beginning, but after a certain degree of violence and that, the ability of regional powers and the global powers to intervene is more, of course, more likely. So this is a lesson to be learned. It's not an easy choice to make, to go to armed struggle against the state. I think we the power of the people, the ability to mobilize, this weakens the ability to mobilize people, armed struggle or violence in general. So, but I, as I said, this is theoretically that, like, you can say that social movements in the Arab Spring, in the second wave of the Arab Spring, we can say about Sudan in the last few months, during the last year actually, or the whole last year, managed to overthrow the head of the state. And they stayed in the street, talked to the street, and fought their battle within many months. It took probably 8 months of mobilization, popular mobilization on the street, and state crackdown, of course, violence from the state. The same in Iraq right now. Right now in Iraq is still happening, the protest movement in Iraq. And it's the state is cracking down, and state violence is very vicious against the protesters in Iraq, but they have not responded with violence yet. Like, I mean, violence with arms. There are clashes and this kind of stuff, and blocking roads and clashing with the security forces. But there are militias in Iraq as well, supported by Iran again. So we can talk about this lesson being learned, but at the same time, it's not really a choice for the Syrian people at the time. If we had the choice not to take up arms, if the people on the ground had this choice not to take up arms, they would definitely do that. But they didn't have this choice. You know, they were not allowed to organize, to gather more than a few people. They started, why this perception about the Syrian revolution using mosques, for example, at the beginning? Some people who are against the Syrian revolution and with the Syrian regime, take this as accusation, as a indication of radicalism, Islamist radicalism from the beginning. But that was for really practical reason, because people were not allowed to gather anywhere. If you gather few people anywhere, you would be killed by security forces. They would shoot at the people gathering. So people in mosques, they were gathered during the Friday ceremony, for example. That was a good opportunity to start a protest from there. And then the mosque would be surrounded by security forces and the crackdown start. So it was very difficult. The people of Syria had only two options, either to surrender, not to organize at all, or if you want to continue and organize, you have this only option, is to take up arms. And they choose the second one, actually. And this is not a decision, as I said, it's not an organized movement. It's not a decision of certain people, of a group or two groups or three groups or 10. This is just how the situation developed. This is a massive popular uprising and movements, and each area took different decision. Actually, certain areas took them really, really long time to take up arms, for example. This is local decisions. Each local area organized and decided what they're going to do independently somehow, you know? So this is what I would say.
You mentioned that a lot of people had been imprisoned and tortured for organizing and for different kinds of dissent. I guess, did you want to speak a bit about prison specifically and that aspect of the regime's violence?
Yeah, actually, the prisons in Syria, even before the uprising, were just places of torture and mass killing. They are not really prisons. They're just institutions of torture and torture, basically, before the uprising, but also killing. But after the uprising, they turned into just institutions of just accumulating dissidents, people who oppose to the Assad regime, torturing them to death or just killing them, just getting rid of people, because it was a massive participation, massive uprising. I mean, we're talking about millions of people participating, like active participation in politics. These prisons were overwhelmed with the number of people there, and they practiced all kind of torture and deliberately killed them, like torture, not death because of torture, you know, but torturing people to death. The intention was to kill people. We're talking about almost 200,000 people went to the Syrian prison and disappeared. And then their families would receive a notice from the security forces that your daughter or son was killed, died in prison, and you can, some in very rare cases, they can go and take the body or to see their son. They just receive notice and they don't know anything about them. These are people, like almost 90,000 people received these kind of death notice, you know. And as I said, the vast majority of those are activists, are democratic activists, you know, with democratic aspirations. And this is a very big wound in the Syrian people's mind, and it's very, very tragic thing to talk about and to remember. All people feel the same about this, about when talking about the Syrian prisons.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciated.
Yeah, my pleasure, actually. Thank you so much for having me and having this opportunity to talk about the Syrian revolution from this different, I would say, perspective that's not very much covered and examined. Thank you so much.
KiteLine is a weekly 30-minute radio program focusing on issues in the prison system. You'll hear news along with stories from prisoners and former prisoners, as well as their loved ones. You'll learn what prison is, how it functions, and how it impacts all of us.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
You can hear us on the Channel Zero Network and find out more at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.